The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power by Robert A. Caro, Part 3, continued on cassette number 3, side 1. Johnson and Wirtz also may have appealed to other sides of the president's character. Roosevelt, Joseph Alsop, and Robert Kintner were to write, had earlier told Johnson and other Texan New Dealers that he wanted no part of a fight against Garner in Texas, but then he was shown documents and other evidence of the character of the Garner campaign in Wisconsin and Illinois, which was extremely bitter and highly personal in its attacks on the president. This angered him. Jesse Jones again pleaded with him not to carry the fight into Garner's home state, but the Texan New Dealers voiced the opposing view, and the president agreed. Whatever the reasons for Roosevelt's reversal, on April 12th, Wirtz was able to write Mayor Tom Miller of Austin, "The president has not called off the dogs, and you can take this as authentic. Everything from this end looks good. I asked Ed Clark to communicate with you and Harold Young, and let me know who you all could agree on a state organizer with absolute authority to discuss the campaign, and what such a campaign would cost." The campaign Wirtz was talking about, Clark was soon informed, was a war in which no quarter was to be given, a battle in the precinct conventions, in the state convention, a well-financed campaign to take from Garner even the votes of his own state. And whatever Roosevelt's reasons for wanting to continue the fight against Garner in Texas, the motive of Johnson and Wirtz was now to become more clear, because of the nature of the campaign they directed. Although it was ostensibly a campaign against John Garner, its real target was not Garner, but Sam Rayburn. Rayburn was determined to save Garner from the humiliation of having to fight to hold on to his own state. For months he had worked loyally for his old friend. "I do hope," he wrote a Texas ally on March 8, 1940, "that we can keep down any contest in Texas. I am working on the people who I think might lead a third-term movement in Texas just as hard as I can to keep it down." But as the hopelessness of Garner's candidacy had become evident, he had begun working for a compromise that would save the 71-year-old vice president from embarrassment and let him retire from public life with dignity. The solution he devised was to have the Texas convention instruct the state's delegation to cast a first ballot vote for Garner, while at the same time endorsing Roosevelt's policies, to make clear that support of its favorite son candidate did not mean die-hard opposition to the president, and to end any hope of a Stop Roosevelt movement, to which Rayburn was, of course, opposed. Going to the White House, he had sued for an honorable peace on behalf of the man with whom he had worked for 30 years, and had for a time thought he had succeeded. Roosevelt, who at the time had decided to drop the fight in Texas, agreed. As one newspaper put it, his, the president's, first act, designed to restore friendly political relations with Garner, was to inform New Dealers in Texas that he has no desire of contesting the vice president for the Lone Star State's 46 delegates. After Johnson and Wirtz persuaded the president to change his mind, and the campaign for the delegates was resumed under their direction, the direction pointed straight at Rayburn. It was kicked off with a telegram to him. Ed Clark and Tom Miller, two Austinites acting under orders from Johnson and Wirtz, sent a telegram to Rayburn on Thursday, April 12th, demanding to know how he stood as between President Roosevelt and Vice President Garner. The Garner organization in Texas, it said, has been engaged in a very unwise, cruel, and ruthless effort to politically assassinate Roosevelt. We concede your past loyalty to the Democratic Party and trust that you will again evidence this by not trying to stop Roosevelt. In his reply to this telegram, and in subsequent events, was given definitive proof of Sam Rayburn's character. The going was to be very tough for his friend now, wrote columnists Drew Pearson and Robert S. Allen. The great Lone Star State of Texas, where Jack Garner was born and with whose heretofore unfailing backing he rose to fame and fortune, is today the stage of what, in the opinion of insiders, will be his last political battle. For the grizzled old warrior, it is a bitter and ironic clash, bitter because he finds himself on the defensive in his home bailiwick, where he reigned supreme for many years. Ironic because he actually is only a pawn in a struggle in which he has no personal stake. but throughout his last battle, Sam Rayburn stood beside him like a rock. Torn between his loyalty to Roosevelt and his close personal friendship with Garner and the old leaders, the colonists wrote, he is the unhappiest man in the bitter melee. Sam also fears the effect it may have on his own speakership ambitions. But his reply to the Clark Miller telegram was unequivocal. No knowing person doubts my loyalty to the policies and accomplishments of the Roosevelt administration, and I shall advocate that the convention pass resolutions strongly endorsing those policies and accomplishments, he said. But, he added, John Garner has been a distinguished congressman from Texas for 30 years. He has been the state's only speaker and vice president, its most distinguished citizen since Sam Houston. His fellow citizens of Texas should honor him by sending a delegation to the National Convention instructed to vote for him for the Democratic nomination for president. A maneuver by Lyndon Johnson's followers had thus forced Rayburn to take a stand against Roosevelt. But what good was the maneuver if the stand was not known, and widely known? What good was the maneuver if the stand did not receive wide publicity, if Rayburn was not portrayed publicly as a foe of the president, as part of the Stop Roosevelt movement? The Clark Miller telegram of Thursday did not find its way into print, and neither did Rayburn's reply of Saturday. So on Sunday another attempt was made to get the news out. A discreet leak was made to Paul Bolton, an INS reporter in Austin friendly to Johnson. He would later work for him. Approaching Mayor Miller at Austin's annual Dogwood Day dinner on Sunday night, Bolton said, in Miller's words, that he heard from Washington that I had a message from Rayburn. This attempt failed because Miller had not been informed of the part he was supposed to play. Not realizing that the exchange of telegrams was supposed to be made public, the mayor replied that he considered Rayburn's telegram a personal message that I did not care to divulge. That attempt having failed, still another device was employed to get Rayburn's position publicized. As Miller put it, someone from Washington wired a special story about the telegram to a great many Texas newspapers. This device worked. Rayburn's stand was on the front page, and portrayed in the light in which it was supposed to be portrayed. Rayburn backs Garner, the Washington Post headlined on Monday morning. The device also gave Clark and Miller an opportunity to send another telegram with guaranteed publicity. As if Rayburn's answer had not been clear enough, they wired, "We concede your past loyalty to the Democratic Party, and we trust that you will again evidence this by not trying to stop Roosevelt. Are you trying to stop Roosevelt along with Roy Miller and Blaylock, or do you just want to give Mr. Garner a first-round complimentary vote at Chicago?" These telegrams had their intended effect. As the lead paragraph in the Dallas Morning News story put it, Majority Leader Sam Rayburn of the House of Representatives was brought squarely into the Roosevelt-Garner fight. And he was brought into that fight in the way Johnson intended. The crucial phrase, "Stop Roosevelt," had been emphasized. Rayburn was portrayed as a leader not just of the Garner campaign, but of the Stop Roosevelt movement. And the reaction from Roosevelt was all that could have been desired by the men who had conceived these maneuvers. Johnson and Wirtz would, during the week following Rayburn's statement, have three conferences at the White House. After the final one, Wirtz, in a press conference on the White House steps, said that Rayburn's statement appeared to the president as an attack from within the administration, and that Roosevelt felt Rayburn had not correctly portrayed his views. Wirtz said he was returning to Texas to lead an all-out fight to take the delegation away from Garner. In that fight, Rayburn was to continue to be as much a target as the man he was representing. As a young Texas politician wrote Rayburn following an April 24th rally orchestrated by Wirtz, "At the New Deal rally here in Dallas, your name was lugged into the discussion mainly by Mayor Tom Miller of Austin, and some of the others tried in a subtle manner to connect you with certain men who are supporting Mr. Garner." Subtle and shrewd, the Johnson-Wirtz strategy gave Johnson what he wanted, as a third telegram would show. When Wirtz arrived back in Texas, the all-out fight turned out to be something less. After an initial explosion of impassioned rhetoric, Wirtz said that he had no objection to the Texas delegation giving a first ballot favorite son vote to Garner, so long as it was not part of a Stop Roosevelt movement. The Garner leaders thereupon expressed understandable puzzlement over the reason for the all-out fight. As soon as the national sentiment for Roosevelt had become unmistakable, they had repeatedly suggested, they said, the very proposal that Wirtz was now suggesting. Blaylock, Garner's state chairman, said, "As heretofore repeatedly stated, we shall advocate that all Texas conventions, precinct, county, and state, pass resolutions endorsing the achievements and accomplishments of the Roosevelt administration. Nothing else has ever been in the minds of the Garner advocates." That statement was disingenuous regarding the period, now just a memory, when Garner had felt he had a chance to win. But it accurately described the feelings of the Garner leaders since the Wisconsin primary. And it had been Rayburn's desire even before Wisconsin. In the event, Rayburn achieved what he had wanted for Garner. Substantial sums of Herman Brown's money were spent on a campaign to elect at the precinct and county conventions delegates who would vote for Roosevelt in the first ballot. The third term was advertised on radio as well as in newspapers. But the campaign did not shake Garner's control of the party apparatus. A compromise was therefore agreed upon. It was Rayburn's compromise. In effect, it would be almost precisely the proposal he had made weeks before. Under the terms of the compromise, it would be sealed by a telegram, in the interest of harmony, to political leaders in Texas. The telegram said, "Texas Roosevelt supporters should endorse native son John Garner and send delegation instructed to vote for his nomination for the presidency. Garner organization and his supporters will insist that state convention approve and acclaim administration record and will refuse to be a party to any Stop Roosevelt movement. We think both sides should get together and send delegation to the national convention, which will carry out above program. We feel sure such an understanding would not be displeasing to the president." To achieve the compromise and thus salvage Garner's dignity, however, Rayburn was subjected to embarrassment, embarrassment which was to have profound political consequences. In conferences between Tommy Corcoran, Harold Ickes, and Lyndon Johnson in Washington, and over the telephone with Alvin Wirtz in Texas, it was decided that the telegram should be signed not only by Rayburn, as leader of the Garner forces, but by a leader of the Roosevelt forces. And that leader would be Lyndon Johnson. Because the text of the telegram indicated that the compromise, while guaranteeing Texas votes for Garner, was not a total victory, Rayburn would have preferred that it not be sent, and that if it was sent, it be released to the press in Texas, so that, as Ickes put it, it would be less likely to attract national attention. Johnson, Corcoran, Ickes, and Wirtz, however, insisted that it be released from the White House, but that Johnson go with Rayburn to show the telegram to the president. Rayburn balked at this, Ickes wrote in his secret diary. He did not want to go to the White House, one of his reasons being that he did not want it to appear that in a Texas political matter, a kid congressman like Lyndon Johnson was on apparently the same footing as himself, the majority leader. But the compromise gave Rayburn's old friend what Rayburn wanted him to have, the chance to retire with pride, to leave public life with his state's unanimous vote behind him. The compromise also endorsed the accomplishments of the Roosevelt administration, which Rayburn had helped bring about, and in which he believed so deeply. And Johnson and Wirtz held another trump card. With the precinct conventions rapidly approaching, failure to seal the compromise would result in the intrastate fight against Garner that Rayburn had been trying to avoid. For Garner's sake, Rayburn agreed to their terms. Johnson here and Wirtz in Texas forced the issue until Rayburn reluctantly agreed to go to the White House, Ickes wrote. They were shown into the president's office on April 29th. When Johnson and Rayburn appeared in the president's office that afternoon, he told them benignly that they had been good little boys and that they had Papa's blessing. He treated them as political equals, with the malicious intent of disturbing Sam Rayburn's state of mind. I think that he succeeded. Whether or not Rayburn was disturbed by the White House meeting, he was deeply disturbed by subsequent events. He had assumed that whatever the causes of the tension with the New Dealers who had once been his allies, the compromise had ended them. "I am sure," he wrote to a friend, "that no one thinks that I am anti-Roosevelt, as I think all will agree that I've done about as much to help him carry out his program as anybody in the United States. What I have wanted was to have a delegation from Texas, without a fight and representing all elements of the party in Texas." But that assumption failed to take into account certain aspects of the president's character. Roosevelt would show an unwillingness to forgive, ever, this man who he believed had been part of a Stop Roosevelt movement. Rayburn was shortly to rise to the place he had envisioned for himself as a boy. Speaker Bankhead died of a stomach hemorrhage on September 15th. The hollowness of the New Dealer's threats to deny Rayburn power in the House was revealed by the proceedings to select Bankhead's successor. They took 2 minutes and were unanimous. No one even suggested a name other than Rayburn's. The next day, with Bankhead's body lying in state in the well of the chamber, Rayburn stood above the casket, on the topmost tier of that triple-tiered dais, in front of that single, high-backed chair, and took the oath that his fellow Texan Garner had taken 9 years before. He made no speech. Except for a brief eulogy to Bankhead, he said only, picking up the speaker's gavel, "The House shall be in order." To a friend a few days later, he said, referring to the town in which he had attended a one-room schoolhouse, "It's a fur piece from Flag Springs." And he added, "I still can't realize I'm speaker." Then he returned to Bonham, where his constituents honored him by coming to a barbecue in a caravan of cars more than a mile long, each bearing his picture. Before he went to the celebration, he made another stop, the cemetery, to stand before his parents' grave. But Rayburn's attainment of his lifelong aim was to bring him only limited satisfaction during the 4.5 years that remained of Roosevelt's presidency. His image of the speakership had never been limited merely to a gavel and power. "I would rather link my name indelibly with the living, pulsing history of my country, and not be forgotten entirely after a while, than to have anything else on earth," he had written. He had always felt that the House of Representatives, as a sovereign branch of government, had rights and prerogatives, that it should not merely respond to initiatives of the executive branch, but should play a role in the initiation of national policy. As its leader, he had felt, he would be entitled to such a role. Specifically, since the House as a whole was too unwieldy to initiate policy, he had believed that a strong speaker would be included by the President in the policy-making process, would, because he understood the will of the House and could represent that will, at least be consulted while policy was being formulated. His ambitions had never been only for himself. He had always thought of himself in the terms he had enunciated in his first speech in the House so many years before, as a voice for people who had no other voice, as a voice for his beloved farmers. A man who met him for the first time on a train crossing Texas in 1935 saw him sitting, staring in serious reflection across the countryside. The man introduced himself, and Rayburn, only half shaken out of his musings, said, as if to himself, "Where is the farmer going? Where is America going?" This man, who was to become Rayburn's friend, says that he was a farmer at heart, but with an ambition to help his own kind. He wanted passionately, farmers to have a voice in the highest councils of government, and he had always believed that, after he became speaker, he would be that voice. He was not, during Roosevelt's presidency, to have what he had expected to have. He remained loyal, a rock for Roosevelt in the 40s as he had been in the 30s. The three previous speakers, Rainey, Burns, and Bankhead, had been weak. At the time Rayburn picked up the gavel, the potential power of the speakership had been all but forgotten. Under Rayburn, it was to be remembered. And his strength and personal popularity comprised a key factor in the passage, in that body dominated by anti-New Deal Southerners, of much legislation that otherwise might not have been passed, despite Roosevelt's wishes. "Hell, Sam," said one, "if it wasn't for you, there are about 50 of us from the South who'd walk right out on him." His strength was at Roosevelt's service in foreign affairs as well. In August 1941, the Selective Service Act, which had a year earlier established America's first peacetime draft, was about to expire. Unless the act was extended, not only would most of the men in uniform be discharged, but no new ones could be drafted. And despite Roosevelt's pleas for extension, pressure on Congress to let it die had reached almost a frenzy under the prodding of powerful isolationist organizations and of delegations of mothers. Rayburn knew the draft was needed. Talking with George Brown, he suddenly fell silent. The grim face turned even grimmer. After a while, he said quietly, "The war clouds are gathering, George." Rayburn didn't stay in the speaker's chair during the 3 days of bitter debate. He went back to the spot in which he had stood for so many years, back behind the rail, and he worked the cloakroom, calling in almost 30 years' worth of favors. Wrote a friend, "This was a time when he did not hesitate, all else failing, to make the ultimate plea. Do this for me." As he returned to the chair to preside over the vote on the bill, the galleries above him crammed with uniformed soldiers on leave, weeping mothers and isolationist delegations, he knew he had not picked up enough votes. But he had the gavel in his hand. The Republicans were holding back the votes of several GOP congressmen opposed to the act, and several others were planning to change their votes from support to opposition as soon as they saw how many votes were needed to defeat the measure, since under House rules, a member can change his vote until the result is announced. They never got a chance. Without the new votes and the switches, the slip the tally clerk handed to Rayburn was 203 for the bill, 202 opposed. In the very moment he read those figures, Rayburn pounded down his gavel and announced the vote, freezing it. Enraged Republicans, milling in the well of the House, demanded reconsideration. By using, too fast for his opponents to keep up with him, a series of intricate parliamentary procedures, and finally, when he was cornered, pounding down his gavel to finalize the vote and grimly defying their leaders to do something about it, he kept the one-vote margin. He had stretched House rules to a point at which they would have broken had not the power of his iron personality stood behind his rulings. But, a friend wrote, the end result was that, when Japanese bombers struck Pearl Harbor less than 4 months later, the United States had an army of 1,600,000 men instead of a token force of 400,000. But if he was to be allowed to push through Roosevelt's policies, he was to be allowed very little voice in their formulation. The charming presidential missives on Bonham's annual Sam Rayburn Day resumed. The two men had been born in the same month in 1882, and each January birthday greetings were exchanged, charming greetings from Roosevelt, admiring greetings from the man who had Roosevelt's picture on his desk at home. "I thank God for you on this day, because at 60 years of age you are ripe and strong for the burden that would crush a less determined man," Rayburn wrote in January 1942. Real input into policy was not, however, to be among the favors Roosevelt conferred. Each Monday, in meetings highly publicized by the press, Rayburn and McCormick of the House, Barclay of the Senate, and Vice President Wallace would meet with the President, ostensibly to map policy, in luncheons marked by camaraderie and joking. Sam Rayburn mentioned that he had been in conference with Mrs. Luce. The President and all the rest of us began to kid him, and Sam turned pink. But Rayburn was not impressed by such stroking, or by the crowd of photographers who would snap the Big Four on the White House steps as they were leaving. These meetings, Henry Wallace was to note, aroused Rayburn's resentment, because at them, the President never suggests any legislation, so that the meetings amounted to no more than glad-hand affairs of very little significance. On another occasion, Rayburn complained to Wallace that the President didn't take him sufficiently into his confidence. Nonetheless, Wallace also noted, Rayburn was quite loyal to Roosevelt. Jonathan Daniels saw how easily Rayburn's feelings were hurt, and Daniels saw how often Roosevelt hurt them. He said he felt he could be much more useful if he could see the President by himself. I asked him if he could not do this, and he said of course he could, but he gave the impression of feeling that his advice was not wanted. A few of the younger men around the President, such as Corcoran and Cohen, and the even younger, more junior Jim Rowe, admired Rayburn. "Your country owes you a great deal which most of the plain people will never know about," Rowe wrote him. But after 1940, Corcoran and Cohen faded from the White House scene. To the remaining members of the White House inner circle, men such as Steve Early, Paul Watson, and Marvin McIntyre, and women such as Missy LeHand and Grace Tully, and to bright young newcomers to that circle, Rayburn was indistinguishable from other Southern conservatives. More important, to this palace guard to whom disloyalty to the President was the cardinal sin, Rayburn had been, they believed, a leader of the Stop Roosevelt movement. This feeling echoed the attitude of their boss, a man to whom a sturdy independent such as Rayburn's was not a prized quality. Their attitude toward this slow-talking Texan was snide. After a Rayburn speech, McIntyre jotted a sarcastic memo to Roosevelt. Understand, Sam was very proud of his literary effort. When Daniels told McIntyre that Rayburn's pride had been worn thin by his treatment at the White House, McIntyre replied that Rayburn, like all other speakers, has gotten swell-headed. Rayburn told Roe, "There's nobody in the White House I can talk to." Because of the size of Texas and the philosophical as well as geographical diversity among its various regions, there had not been a single person through whom the White House worked in Texas, as there might have been in a smaller, more unified state. Nonetheless, for a long time, Garner had been the key link between the White House and Texas, the individual to whom, more than any other, the Roosevelt administration had turned first in matters of patronage and policy affecting the great province to the southwest. Now Garner was gone. With the state's two senators shunning statewide power, with the hollowness of Jesse Jones's professions of loyalty to the New Deal now apparent, and with Maury Maverick waging a losing fight for his own political survival, Garner's role would, in the normal course of events, have been filled by Rayburn, as the state's senior and by far most powerful official in the national government. Once Roosevelt had apparently intended Rayburn to fill that role. He had begun giving him the Texas patronage that would have cemented that position. Normally, Roosevelt would have continued doing so. The new speaker's advice would have been the first solicited in matters of both policy and politics affecting the state. Normally, Sam Rayburn would have been the president's man in Texas. But he wasn't. The telegrams to Rayburn from Austin had been cleverly designed to force him into a position which would antagonize the president. Lyndon Johnson's vivid description to Roosevelt of the John L. Lewis episode had emphasized Rayburn's anti-Roosevelt role, as had the reports Johnson and Wirtz gave to the president at their private meetings. Rayburn's statement appeared to the president as an attack from within the administration. And the telegrams, together with the leaked newspaper stories about them, stories that relied on information from Johnson, cemented that impression. After those telegrams, the White House had an accurate impression of Sam Rayburn as a Garner supporter, but it also had a false impression of Rayburn as Roosevelt's enemy, as a leader not only of the Garner campaign, but of the whole Stop Roosevelt movement, as the enemy of the man he not only idolized, but whom he had on 100 occasions loyally served. After those telegrams, Sam Rayburn could never be Roosevelt's man in Texas. He had been tarred beyond cleansing by a brush wielded by Lyndon Johnson, and the tarring gave Johnson what he wanted. By mid-1940, Johnson was Roosevelt's man in Texas. As Washington columnist J. Franklin reported, "A virtual freshman representative is now the acknowledged New Deal spokesman in the Lone Star State." The most significant aspect of this development involved federal contracts. Before 1940, Jesse Jones had frequently been consulted on these contracts. As RFC head, Jones would, of course, award RFC contracts himself. After 1940, Jones was to be largely ignored. Before 1940, Senators Connally and Shepard had occasionally been consulted, not as often as Connally in particular would have liked, but occasionally. After 1940, requests from the senators for input into contract awards were fobbed off. And before 1940, the Texan most often consulted had been John Garner. Rayburn's lack of interest in this area was already legendary in Washington. Once, following authorization of the Denison Dam in his district, he had been discreetly sounded out on the identity of his favorite contractor. "He didn't have one," he replied. But in the normal course of events, the opinion of the Speaker of the House of Representatives would at least have been asked when a major public works or defense contract was to be handed out in his state. Now it would not be. Freezing Jones, Connally, Shepard, and Rayburn out of major contract decisions in Texas did not, however, result in a vacuum in this crucial area. For even as the vacuum was being created, it was being filled by the man who had done so much to create it, a virtual freshman representative. Johnson's influence over the Corpus Christi Naval Air Station contract had in itself given him a major role in construction in Texas, for so huge was that $100 million piece of work in that state, the total amount of work let by the State Highway Department in 1940 was only $27 million, that Brown and Root put to work on it subcontractors from all over the state. And with the nation gearing up for war with growing intensity, and with the military bases that already dotted Texas expanding, his influence was to increase, for the word was passed by the White House that Lyndon Johnson was to be consulted on expansion contracts. Minuscule though these contracts may have been in comparison with gigantic Corpus Christi, they were important to the firms which received them. In Johnson's own district, for example, a contract for approximately $71,000 to the Taylor Bedding Company for mattresses for Navy barracks was one of the largest this firm had ever received, as were federal contracts for several hundred thousand dollars of construction work that went to the Ainsworth Construction Company of Luling. Contractors all across Texas were grateful for REA line-laying contracts arranged by Johnson. The word was out in Washington. Federal contracts in Texas were, as Corcoran puts it, to be given to Lyndon's friends. And, Corcoran says, once he could get public money for his friends, he was made. He was indeed made by the public money represented by federal contracts. He had been able to bring to the Roosevelt re-election campaign a resource which no other Texan could offer, Herman Brown's money. And he had used that resource as a base. Because he could provide that money to the Roosevelt campaign in Texas, he was given a commanding role in that campaign. Because he played that role, he was given input into the awarding of other federal contracts. Because he possessed that input, men who wanted those contracts, and they included some of the most powerful men in Texas, had to come to him. In a sense, that third telegram had signaled this fact. Lyndon Johnson's name had been placed beside Rayburn's on that telegram. He had been treated by the president as on the same footing with the majority leader of the House of Representatives. Treating Johnson as Rayburn's equal in the Oval Office, of course, had had merely symbolic significance. Treating him as a full-fledged power in Texas in the awarding of federal contracts had a significance that went far beyond symbolism. Men who could read the map of power understood the significance of the fact that the largest contract ever awarded in Texas, a contract of almost unbelievable magnitude, had been awarded to Lyndon Johnson's friend. Ickes could describe him as a kid congressman. Kid, in some terms, he may have been, a 31-year-old congressman from a remote and isolated political district. But after that telegram, he was, in terms of power, a kid congressman no longer. Unknown though his name remained to the public in the state's other 20 congressional districts, it was now not only known but respected by powerful and influential men in those districts. Lyndon Johnson had been maneuvering since shortly after coming to Washington as a congressional secretary in 1931 to obtain statewide power. Now he was able to procure for men who mattered in Texas, all across Texas, not merely hotel reservations and appointments with federal officials, but federal contracts. Thanks to Herman Brown's money and to the skill with which he had employed it as a political resource, he was much further now along the road he saw stretching before him. He was Roosevelt's man in Texas, but he was not only Roosevelt's man. The president's popularity with the mass of Texas voters was matched by his unpopularity with the small group of men who ran the state with such a tight grip, as had been proven by the overwhelming roar of acclaim for Garner and his candidacy in the state's Democratic Executive Committee and in precinct, county, and state nominating conventions. The president's popularity was, moreover, strictly personal and could not be taken to include voter support of his policies, as had been proven by the defeat of congressmen who supported the New Deal. Only one of the state's 21 congressional districts, Lyndon Johnson's 10th, could be said to be safely liberal. In those few districts, no more than three or four, which were represented by congressmen such as Sam Rayburn, who supported the president, the congressmen had won election by virtue of their personal popularity rather than by their accord with their constituents' views. Even after Garner's last hopes of victory in the presidential nominating race had vanished, the state organization was controlled as tightly as ever by men who had once been bound together by their allegiance to Cactus Jack, but who were now bound, as tightly as ever, by allegiance to a philosophy diametrically opposed to that of the New Deal. Their leader's views would not change. Back home in Uvalde, he pinned a Wilkie button to his lapel. 20 years later, he would still be railing against the policies of the man with whom he had twice run to great national victories. And neither would theirs. Many of the leaders of the Garner campaign would, in 1944, be the Texas regulars who deserted the Democratic Party rather than support Franklin D. Roosevelt. But however deep their resentment of the New Deal as a whole, or of the Texas leaders of the anti-Garner campaign, the objects of that resentment did not include Lyndon Johnson. The reason was simple. They didn't know he was one of the leaders. Johnson's attempt to conceal his views in the Garner-Roosevelt fight had, of course, begun in its beginning. During the very time when he was privately regaling New Dealers with the way he had defied Sam Rayburn to his face, in front of the whole Texas delegation, he was dodging every attempt to make him take a public position in the Roosevelt-Garner fight. His dodging led to an incorrect conclusion, for the AP noted that he had recently joined in a statement expressing regard for Garner. And he had attempted to keep his profile low, invisible in fact, during the whole of that almost year-long battle. When a Roosevelt for President committee was established in Texas, Tom Miller, not Lyndon Johnson, was its president, Ed Clark its secretary. Miller and Clark, and Maury Maverick, and Harold Young, and, in the battle's concluding stages, even Alvin Wirtz, might be roaming Texas making speeches, but Lyndon Johnson appeared on no speaker's platform. As much as possible, he did not appear in Texas. The brief trip he made to Austin in March appears, in fact, to have been the only time he ventured within the state's borders during the months in which the Roosevelt-Garner battle was at its height there. The lengths to which he would stay out of the state were most dramatically demonstrated when Austin's Tom Miller Dam, another LCRA project, was dedicated on April 6, 1940. Johnson had obtained the funds for the dam. At the dedication of other dams on the lower Colorado and of every other construction project in his district, he was invariably present and went to great lengths to assure himself the lion's share of the publicity. When the Tom Miller Dam was dedicated, the only evidence of Austin's congressman was his name on a plaque and a telegram expressing his regret that he could not be present because of work yet to be accomplished in Washington. When he was forced to enter the state, he stayed out of its newspapers. Johnson was being very cagey, says Van Kennedy, editor of the State Observer, a weekly published in Austin. Johnson was being very cautious about getting himself exposed to any unnecessary fire. Harold Young, who was receiving so much monetary assistance from Johnson, came to realize, to his shock, for he had heard Johnson railing against Garner privately, that he would not do so publicly. Lyndon didn't any more want to take a stand on Garner than he wanted to take a stand against the Martin Dies Committee, Young says. It was at this time that the Texas liberal and Rayburn man William Cottrell first coined an expression about Johnson. Lyndon will be found on no barricades. He may not have been present even at the riotous State Democratic Convention in Waco, at which the state's delegation was chosen after fistfights between Garner and Roosevelt supporters. If he was at Waco, he kept a low profile indeed. Asked years later, was Mr. Johnson at the state convention? E.B. Germany, Garner's reactionary, Roosevelt-hating state chairman, was to reply, I don't think he was there. If he was there, I don't see how he stayed away, but I don't remember seeing him at the state convention. He did not materialize on a speaker's platform where he could be seen by influential Texans until the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, by which time, of course, the battle was over, so he was not called upon to declare his preference. His efforts at secrecy were successful. The Austin American Statesman, which took editorial direction directly from its owner, Charles Marsh, almost never mentioned his name in connection with the Roosevelt-Garner fight. As late as March 17, 1940, for example, an article by Raymond Brooks listed the leaders of the Roosevelt campaign in Texas, and Johnson was not mentioned. He stayed out of other newspapers as well. Articles in Texas newspapers identified Tom Miller and Ed Clark, and later Alvin Wirtz, as leaders, and included other names: State Democratic Chairwoman Frances Haskell Edmondson, Maury Maverick, Railroad Commissioner Jerry Sadler, former Attorney General William McCraw, Harold Young. Seldom was the name of Lyndon Johnson included, and when it was as only a minor figure in the movement to deny the favorite son vote to Garner. 4 months after he had summed up the state's political situation without mentioning Johnson's name, Walter Hornaday, chief political writer of the Dallas Morning News, added, "The Garner leaders also believe that Representative Lyndon Johnson is active in the third-term movement." The fight ended with his anonymity still successfully preserved. The State Observer's June 3rd issue, the issue which covered in detail the Waco Convention that was the fight's final battle, identified Tom Miller as the originator of the Draft Roosevelt movement in Texas. As for the movement's other leaders, the Observer listed many names. The name Lyndon Johnson does not appear even once in that issue. One Texas newspaper did attempt at least obliquely to reveal and explain his role, and the reaction to these attempts is instructive. The paper was the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and it may have understood Johnson's role because its publisher, Amon G. Carter, while reactionary in his political philosophy and a longtime Garner supporter — it was Carter's famous Stetsons that Garner always wore in Washington — wanted huge new public works for his beloved Fort Worth, and to get them, had maintained ties with the White House. On March 23, 1940, Carter not only expressed the bitterness of the Garnerites in a long editorial, "Normal Texans are unable to understand those calling themselves Texans who go about urging Texas to desert Garner and to weasel out of its duty to stand by its own," but also attempted to explain the significance to the Roosevelt movement of public works in the state's 10th congressional district, and of the district's congressmen. "The whole third-term outfit gathers round a dam site on the Colorado," Carter wrote. On April 7th, the Star-Telegram sharpened its attack. In attributing the motives behind the anti-Garner movement in Texas not to philosophy but to greed, it said, "So far, no advices have come from Washington that dams of the Lower Colorado River Authority will be abandoned in the event Garner becomes president. But an Austin block is alarmed." Noting past federal generosity for Carter's own pet projects in Fort Worth, Ickes replied by jeering that, after Roosevelt was reelected, "You and other such leaders will be the first to hie you to the pie counter for more federal funds." Carter's reaction was to focus his attention more closely on the LCRA dams. Ickes had publicly promised to reveal, when asked, the legal fees paid to private attorneys in connection with all PWA projects. Now Carter instructed his Washington correspondent, Bascom Timmons, to demand from the PWA the total amount of the legal fees paid to Alvin J. Wirtz in connection with LCRA projects. This figure, paid between 1935 and 1939, was $85,000, a staggering amount in terms of legal fees customary in Texas at the time. And the $85,000 from the PWA was only a drop in the bucket that Wirtz had filled at those dams. Once the question of his legal fees was opened, it might be only a matter of time before it was discovered that he had received, for work on the dams, fees not only from the PWA, but as the attorney for the Insull interests, as court-appointed receiver of those interests in bankruptcy proceedings, and, of course, from Brown and Root. If a spotlight was turned on those dams, moreover, the congressman responsible for their construction, the congressman who had pushed for those legal fees, would be caught in its glare. The light had to be turned off. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.